and you're listening to the Talkline Network over WVIP 93.5 FM HD2, New Rochelle, New York. We are America's only Jewish radio program on regular broadcast radio on the internet and digital platforms. Enjoy.
You are listening to
Talkline Network Radio, America's longest-running Jewish broadcast network, the voice of the Jewish community.
What are we gonna do with our children? What are we gonna do to show we care? How are we gonna be there for our children when they feel that life has just not been that fair?
Good evening and welcome back to Mask's weekly radio show on Family Matters. Mask, mothers and fathers aligned, saving kids, kids of all ages and all stages for all mental health struggles. If you know someone that needs a referral for a therapist, an inpatient or outpatient program, please give us a call. Our number is 718-758-0400. I'll repeat the number. Maybe it's for yourself, a loved one, a neighbor, or someone you usually would sit next to in shul. All calls are kept strictly confidential. You can call anonymously. Our number again, 718-758-0400. Tonight, I'm really happy to have on with us a colleague and a dear friend, somebody that is one of my go-tos when it comes to inpatient programs, therapy, outpatient, transitional living, and that is Jane Davis. Jane has been in many different roles and has worked with children, adolescents, adults, and families, and she really has great resources that our clients can really gain a lot of information from. Over the years working with Jane, it's always been wonderful. So welcome on tonight, Jane. How are you?
I'm doing well, Rahama, and thank you and thank Mask very much for having me on today.
Well, Jane, it's always nice that you have time to come on for the Mask radio show and being there for Mask families. So I really want to talk about what the difference is between duo diagnosis program and a duo license program, because so many people, when they're exploring sending their loved ones or themselves going to a rehab, they really need to know what the difference in the programs are. So I think we should start with the word duo diagnosis so they understand what that is, please, first.
Sure. So a dual diagnosis means you have more than one diagnosable disorder going on at a time. So often the people that you're seeing might be presenting to you as primary addiction, but you've been doing this so long, you know that it's never just primary addiction. It's often anxiety or depression or ADHD with our younger adults. And so that's where the term dual diagnosis comes from. And typically a dual diagnosis, there's always something that's primary. For a lot of our kids that are presenting or our adults that are presenting with an addiction, most people will think that the addiction is their primary diagnosis when often it is actually mental health. And the addictive behaviors are really just a maladaptive coping mechanism for them to figure out what's going on the mental health side of the line. So a dual licensed program is one that is licensed to treat primary addiction, and then they have a license to treat primary mental health, allowing people to admit to the program as one or the other, but more commonly, both are present.
Right. So, you know, many parents call the helpline and they say, I need a rehab for my child or my loved one's addiction. And we always go back on our intakes, first to fourth grade. It doesn't bother me if the person's 28 years old.
Yeah.
I still will go backwards. Because what we're really looking for is what happened that we ended up on drugs or alcohol or whatever their addiction may be. So we usually find it in the intake from their younger years. They'll say, oh, yes, you know, when my child was in seventh grade or when my child was in 10th grade, and then we get to where the story began.
Yes.
So let's also talk about the difference between a trauma-informed perspective and a conventional perspective, please.
Yes. So the real difference is a conventional program perspective is going to ask what happened to you, what caused. They're looking at symptomology, they're not looking at the person. So a trauma-informed program is coming at it from a slightly different perspective. They're asking more about what's going on with the person. They want to know what happened to you, not what's wrong with you, which is what the conventional perspective is. And the trauma-informed is asking what happened to you and how have you adapted to what's happened to you. Conventional, as I mentioned, is going to focus more on individual symptoms and behaviors, where trauma-informed is really going to focus on the entire person and recognize that that person who's sitting in front of us in a clinical setting has been living within their family system, the community system, and those systems impact the way they behave as well. Conventional is really going to look at pathology and labeling and list it as a disorder, that you are sick, ill, or even bad. A trauma-informed program is really much more about recognizing that symptoms or what we label as problems are really just the survival strategies for clients that have had to deal with unresolved trauma. And those clients are generally doing the very best that they can given their circumstances. So it's really kind of flipping things on its head and not looking at using a medical model to view the person sitting in front of you.
Right. And, you know, I want to go to another important matter that families are really concerned with when sending their loved ones to an inpatient program. They want a culturally sensitive program. They want someone that understands their Jewish traditional, whatever traditions of religion, whatever that person may follow. So you're very involved in rehabs and you really know what, you know, we're talking about, and mm-hmm. you've gotten the training. But just so that my listeners understand, you define what a culturally sensitive program actually can look like.
Sure. A culturally sensitive program should be a program where the staff is trained to deal with multi-cultures and have an awareness that the person sitting in front of them is bringing with them the values from their family and from their community, and the importance of keeping those values intact. Sometimes people are quick to point to cultural or religious perceived wounds, and they're insensitive to the fact that something could occur that might be less than, ideal, but that doesn't mean you throw everything away. So a culturally sensitive program wants to keep the strengths and the values of the culture intact. And for me, working with the Jewish community, a big piece of that is often providing really high quality kosher food that's fresh and that's healthy. Sometimes a program is just located in an area where fresh food does not exist. And, food will have to be shipped in frozen. Most places really do try their level best to bring in fresh food because it's just a better outcome. And food, it really is love, but that is a piece of it. The other piece is, if somebody is observant and they want to observe the Sabbath, it's so easy for a program to have a kosher lamp on campus, multiple lamps on campus. It's just such a small gesture on the part of the program to make a resident feel comfortable and at ease that they can practice, and they don't have to go and ask for something that they need. It's already there. Those are just a couple of the things. There are some programs that I've worked with that have really good, strong relationships with local Chabads. And in fact, you helped me navigate when a young woman needed food in a program that was pretty remote, and the Chabad was really our best resource for food, and you helped me navigate that. So there's where there's a will, there's a way. And I think a lot of it is about asking questions. If a program really isn't sure, they need to ask, what will make you comfortable? What can we do to make you feel comfortable? You don't ever want an extra obstacle to the clinical component. But you also have to have knowledge. So when I said that a trained staff is important, staff really does need to know about holidays. They need to know about milestone moments in Judaism specifically. And so having a good trainer work with the team so that the team understands what somebody's actual needs are and what's important to them is really helpful. And I encourage families to always ask those questions. We frequently ask better questions when we're shopping for a car than we do when we're sending a loved one to rehab. So those are really important questions that should always be asked.
Absolutely. Well, thank you for that. So let's talk also about the differences between in-network insurance programs and out-of-network, because so many people have insurance and want to use their insurance. Out-of-network programs are so expensive.
Yes.
And they really want to use their insurance, but not all insurances cover inpatient. Let's talk about the differences in general, please.
Sure. So in-network means that your insurance company has a very active role in deciding your length of stay. They can decide 10 days in, and there's a constant medical review process that goes on. So you could be 10 days into a program and your insurance may say, the policy, that you are entitled to go to a 30-day program. That is not actually true, because the review process, which is occurring every 5 to 10 days typically, is held between the insurance company and somebody on staff at the rehab. And if the insurance company is not hearing certain milestones or thresholds, it's really a threshold being met, the first thing they're going to say is that we don't see a need for treatment at this level. This resident is going to be fine in an outpatient setting. And that could be 7, 10, 12 days into treatment, and now you're transitioning this person again. And I would say that is really the primary reason why facilities, some facilities have been adamant about not going in network, because they don't want to have to fit every resident or patient into a matrix that is not clinically appropriate for them. And you mentioned the expense. It is much more expensive to be in an out-of-network program. But when, if you have out-of-network benefits, which is typically a PPO program of insurance or PPO policy, which every policy is different, but if we can access PPO benefits in this field, we know that we're going to get part of the program paid for by the insurance company. And that range varies wildly from insurance policy to insurance policy. I've seen 10 days covered. I've seen 20, 30. I mean, it's the gamut. But the power in that is that the insurance company cannot dictate what type of treatment you receive. They cannot dictate the length of stay, and they cannot dictate which therapeutic modalities you receive. But I understand, as do many of my colleagues, that out-of-network experiences are not available to every single person. So we try very, very hard to then fit the person's clinical needs into a program that's in network. I always give them the caveat that do not be surprised, especially when it's mental health primary, that your insurance company is not going to cover for more than 5 to 10 days. And you need to advocate for yourself before you admit and say, if this scenario occurs, what are my options? Can you tell me now what the cost to our family would be? And they should always ask, is there a scholarship available? Or will you work with me on cost? Some programs can do that and some cannot, but it's a fair and honest question to answer.
You know, I want to tell you, it's so real what you're saying, because I just spoke with a parent whose child was admitted to a rehab, and the insurance company said you have 28 days on your insurance, and 5 days in, they got the phone call. Insurance says they can no longer stay under the insurance. So that was a decision that the insurance company made, and now the family is like shocked, mm-hmm. and they need to pay out of pocket. So yeah, it's real. I hear this all the time. Parents go in thinking, oh, I have insurance. It says I could send my child inpatient, but it doesn't always cover the amount of days that the policy states. So thank you for that.
My pleasure.
So then we also have the issue of getting your loved one into the rehab, because the parents may be very motivated, but the child, their loved one, may not be motivated. So we do suggest to the parents that they first start off with parent support groups. That is how Mass believes we could help them make change, to get them to change the music in their home so their kids' dance steps could change. So if somebody has a child that needs to go inpatient and doesn't know where to begin, we recommend that the parent first come on to a parent Zoom meeting at MASC, which is, we have our summer schedule. We have Monday night, Dr. Debbie Ackerman, Tuesday night, Dr. Shmuel Brachfeld, Wednesday night, Rabbi Dr. Tworsky. That's summer schedule. And you come onto the group and you learn what to do and, more importantly, what not to do. And then Mass gives a referral of several different rehab connections, like Jane, to call to discuss what your actions will be. But we really don't start with the referral before the parent goes on groups, because parents need to learn what to expect and what not to. And also they'll learn about the things we're discussing here, and they'll answer many of their questions on the group. So what do you want to share about a motivated or a non-motivated client?
So I think having parents be part of a support group prior is genius, because the families often are feeling isolated, afraid, they're feeling shame. And to have peer support around that is huge. It's really a gift where you're helping stabilize them, actually, so that they can ask the correct questions when they get up to searching for the right fit. That, unfortunately, is the easier part of this discussion, because when you're talking about motivation, you have internal motivation and you have external motivation. Internal motivation is the desire to go and get help, which, you know, when you're talking about addiction, is inherently people are going to be resistant, because that's part of the sickness. Then you have external motivation, which is usually somebody is, maybe they're married or they're engaged and their loved ones are drawing a firm line that this is too disruptive to the family, you have to go to treatment. Or you have a high school student and the family is saying, you have to go. And listen, when they're under 18, you can be more persuasive in a lot of ways than when they're over 18. But I've worked with both. I've worked with really highly motivated clients who understand how disruptive their disease state is to their life, or, you know, their depression or trauma or anxiety is prohibiting them from living the life that they want to live, and they are motivated to make change. I've also worked with people who come into treatment kicking and screaming. Part of the job of the residential team is to help de-escalate that sense of, I don't want to be here, and I'm just ticking the box. I'm going to do my 28, 30, 35 days, and I'm out. And so we get to actually see people shift. And some of it is that they're getting support from their peers once they're in a residential treatment facility. They're getting continued support from their family during phone calls with them. And they're getting the support of the clinical team and the residential staff that's there. And so it's not necessarily an indicator for success if somebody goes in to treatment and they're resistant. We expect that in this field.
Right. And many times it can be that they need to go in more than once. They're not always ready the first time. And many parents may put them in too early. And that's why we recommend that they be in treatment with an addiction professional, and parents make the right decisions at the right time. The timing is what's so important as well. Also, Jane, we tell parents that if someone is addicted for several years, going in 28 days is really not ideal at all. We don't suggest 28 days at all. Right. We always say the first month, they're kicking and screaming. They're getting off the drugs, so they're not comfortable. Right. The second month, they're just starting to feel life without drugs in their body, and they start listening to what's going on around them and taking things in. And the third month is when they start really to work it. So if you don't have 90 days funds available or insurance commitment for 90 days, then it's really a rocky boat. I mean, that's just our minimum we recommend is 90 days in residential treatment.
And 90 days would be amazing for most people. But as you said, sometimes they don't have the financial bandwidth for 90 days. And so that's really where a good program is going to say, okay, let's find outpatient programming. So they'll suggest PHP, which is partial hospitalization program, which is a terrible name, but that's what it's called. And what that means is that you're going to outpatient treatment 5 days a week, all day. It's a full day of programming. And you do that for a minimum of 3 weeks. Sometimes it's a little longer depending on the program. And then they would step you down to intensive outpatient program. And you would have another 6 to 12 weeks, typically. Many programs have become really proactive that are intensive outpatient programs, and they're greater than 3 months. So they're really trying to support people living in the real world who probably shouldn't be yet. They're just not strong enough. But their set of circumstances have dictated that residential is not an option. So really solid outpatient programming would be the second best choice for most people.
And also step downs into sober living.
Yes.
Coming out of a rehab and being in that bubble and then coming back home can be very dangerous for some.
Absolutely.
So we recommend that they go to step down, partial hospitalization, intensive outpatient programming, sober living. There are many different resources available, and you need to really learn about those before you send your loved one inpatient. We're running out of time, Jane. What do you want to say to my listeners about the goals for inpatient residential treatment they should have in mind?
They should have goals in mind. A good residential program is actually going to ask the person who's admitting into treatment, what are your goals? They do want to know family goals, but they really want to know, what are your goals while you're here with us? And they're going to help them identify what's important. Is it to be sober? Yes. But is it to be sober so that you can continue in school, so that you can have a better relationship with your family, or to keep your marriage intact? They really want to know what the goals are. For some people, they'll actually say, I want to find joy again. I want to feel emotion again, because they've been so numb for so long. And that is really important, that a resident or potential patient is voicing what their goals are, because their voice needs to be integral to the clinical care that's being presented to them. They have to be an active participant. They cannot be passive in this process. And so that's why treatment facilities will ask about their goals.
Well, Jane, thank you so much for coming on. You're always available for the NAS parents, and we really appreciate it. And I hope to have you on again soon.
Thank you, Rahama. It was truly a pleasure to be here today speaking with you.
So, Jane Davis from Sabino Recovery. Anyone that wants to speak to her, feel free to give us a call at 718-758-0400. And I want to wish everyone a very good evening, a beautiful Shabbos. And always remember, hang in, hold on, and virtually still, hug tight. Tonight's show is in memory of Rivka Bas Yisrael. Please consider to go online to maskparents.org and donate so that we can continue with all the mask programs. Thank you, and have a good night.
Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.